Good afternoon, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well despite the heat and the storms this week. Hope everyone's tree limbs are where they should be. Saw a lot of storm damage on the way. Hopefully not much of that yet to come. I'd like to start with a question today. It is also the title of the message. So here's the audience participation portion of the message with the person on the street question right out of the gate. So go ahead, raise your hands for one of three answers, and don't be embarrassed or worry about how the person next to you answers. I'm not sure how I would have answered this before this study. I thought about having Mr. McNeely actually go around with a microphone, you know, do an actual person on the street type thing, since he's pretty theatrical when he's got a microphone in his hand, but let's just be honest, that'd be a little bit cringy for everybody. So we're going to do it the old-fashioned ways and just raise our hands. Is there a reward for righteous works? Is there a reward for righteous works? How many think yes? Okay, quite a few. How many think no? How many aren't sure? Few honest people in the back. A few honest people in the back. Thank you very much. That's probably where I would have gone. So there have been many different approaches to this question over time, from guaranteed health and wealth prosperity, gospel teaching. Some of you may have seen Creflo Dollar on the televangelist stations back in the day. Not sure if he's still on. He was definitely of that mind. Those kinds of teachings focus on physical blessings for righteousness in this life. To those on the other end of the spectrum who teach that a Christian should have no desire whatsoever to benefit from living righteously, with righteousness being its own reward, as we might say. Well, wealth for good works can sound very appealing from a human point of view, and a mindset of extreme altruism or selflessness that has no motive for gain can seem like it would be the optimal way. But what does the Bible actually say? Well, in the time that we have remaining, let's explore this topic of the rewards for righteous works and see what answers God's Word provides. There are several words in the Old Testament that are used to describe a benefit or reward that one might receive as an outcome that results from their life's activities. So we'll largely refer to those rather than covering them in detail for sake of time, but I would encourage you, it's a good study to follow upward afterward if you're inclined. So one of the primary Hebrew words is chelek. You're supposed to sound like you're clearing your throat. I don't have that practiced down enough. But this word chelek is often translated as portion in the King James Version, and alternately as portion or reward in the New King James. So for a couple of examples that, again, we'll refer and not turn to, in Ecclesiastes 2, verses 3 through 10, and then again in chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, verses 18 through 20, this word shows a correlation of effort to outcome. These passages show a clear cause and effect principle between effort or labor and then benefiting from the fruit or the outcome of that labor. The same word and similar ones express the same effort and outcome relationship with respect to spiritual benefits, most specifically the benefit of an abiding relationship with God. Let's look at one example of that in Psalm 73, the 73rd Psalm, and we'll start reading in verse 25, where the psalmist writes, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forevermore." So in verse 26, this word translated portion is used to describe the cause and effect nature of our relationship with God. Verses 27 and 28 go on to talk about the outcomes of doing good or not doing good in your life. So the psalmist is describing the connection with God that's available to us as an incredible benefit of both choosing to trust him and to align our lives with what he says to do or not to do. This word and others like it are also used in many other Old Testament passages to describe the outcomes of physical and spiritual effort. So let's transition now to focusing on the same concepts expressed in the New Testament, which is where we'll spend the rest of the message. And here we find several passages that provide insight into the rewards that God is planning for those who commit their lives to him and the attitude that we should have toward those blessings. So the primary Greek word that we'll examine for its use in the New Testament is misthos. It's Strong's number 3408 for anyone who likes to look them up. Mounce's expository dictionary explains that this word, quote, denotes compensation that is either earned or merited and may be best translated as wage, as in wages paid for work that a person has been hired to perform. The first scripture that we'll review shows the word being used in Luke's account of Christ's instructions to 70 of his followers who were sent out in pairs of two to prepare the way before him. Let's go to Luke chapter 10. Luke 10. We're going to break into the middle of the story here. Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 5, where Christ is already speaking to the 70, and he says, starting in verse 5, "But whatever house you enter, first say peace to this house. And if a son of peace is there, your peace will rest on it, and if not, it will return to you." Verse 7, "And remain in the same house, eating and drinking such things as they give, for the laborer is worthy of his wages." Word that's translated wages here in verse 7, this is the word misthos, and again, it's clearly indicating both a specific tactical arrangement for the mission that he was sending these 70 on, and a broader principle of life correlating effort in the form of work and services rendered with the tangible benefits that then result from the effort that's been expended. In 1 Timothy 5:18, Paul quotes this statement from Jesus, "A laborer is worthy of his wages," to make the case that the ministry of the church can earn a living, so to speak, based on the physical and spiritual labor that they perform. The next example of this word's usage is found in Matthew's account of the parable of the workers in the vineyard. Let's go to Matthew 20. Matthew chapter 20. Matthew 20, verse 1. Christ says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard." The word translated hire here is misthao, the verb form of misthos, which pretty clearly indicates the intent to provide wages in return for work performed. Notice that Christ states that the kingdom of heaven is like this scenario with the landowner. The word that's translated like here means similar or resembling. So while this is a parable and not a detailed covenant promise per se, the indication is that the principles seen in the story are an accurate representation of how God plans to work with people and administer his government. Now as the parable goes on, the landowner brings workers into the vineyard throughout the day, agreeing with them either to pay a specific amount in the case of the first group of laborers or for a fair amount with the subsequent groups of workers. Then we come to verse 8, verse 8 of Matthew 20. "So when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, 'Call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the first, beginning with the last to the first.'" So the word translated wages is misthos again, and shows a clear application of the principle stated by Christ in Luke 10:7 that we just looked at. These laborers went into the vineyard and they performed the work that the landowner had hired them for. And at the end of the day, they were paid for that work. Now, remember that though this isn't simply talking about a hypothetical situation with an employer and employees, but it's also illustrating the principles on which God's kingdom will operate. And in that vein, before we leave this passage, let's just note that even in the case of wages earned for work performed, what many of the workers received was based on their effort and on the desire of the landowner to be generous. So for those who received a full day's pay for less than a full day's work, a form of grace came alongside them and supplemented their efforts, again illustrating the core principles of how God operates. So now that we've established the usage of this word misthos for scenarios describing the outcome of physical effort, let's review several passages that describe rewards for the faithful that go beyond the context of physical labor and into a clearly spiritual realm. At the end of the passage referred to as the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, the last statements from Matthew 5 verses 11 and 12 that makes it very personal are, for the hearer, are Christ states, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you." Blessed are you. Why is that a blessing? Well, the next verse gives the answer. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward. Same word, misthos. Great is your reward in heaven. So clearly the reward described here is promising a spiritual outcome, not a transfer of physical assets. Later in Matthew's account of Christ's life, we have another similar teaching that expands and solidifies the concept of spiritual action or effort yielding spiritual benefit in return. Let's go to Matthew 10, Matthew chapter 10. Starting in verse 40. Matthew 10, verse 40, Christ states, "He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward." Verse 42, "And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward." The expositor's Bible commentary's explanation of this passage states, "The prophet's reward and the righteous man's reward are kingdom rewards that are the fruits of discipleship." It goes on to point out, in line with Christ's statements, that even those who tangibly accept and support and express solidarity with God's people in their mindset and how they treat them will receive benefits in proportion to their attitude and actions. Christ's teaching in the book of John applies this principle even further for those who then commit to and actively engage in God's way of life. The backdrop of this instruction, you can go ahead and turn to John chapter 4. The backdrop of this is Jesus' conversation with the woman, with the Samaritan woman at the well. The woman had gone back into the city and she was telling others about her encounter with the one who would be the Messiah. And the disciples urged Jesus to eat after this long journey that they had taken. John 4, starting in verse 34, Jesus said to them, to the disciples, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." So clearly the reference to work here is spiritual in nature, not physical. The labor of extending the opportunity for salvation. So Jesus clearly had a central role in that work, and his disciples in every age are called to labor alongside him in that effort, both developing their own character and spiritual maturity and sharing the gospel as examples and witnesses to others. The Nelson Study Bible's comments on this verse highlight that responsibility. It states, quote, "This food is not simply knowing the will of God, but doing it. It is practice or output. Too often we stop with input rather than going on to output or productivity. So again, clearly this is referring to a spiritual work. Continuing in verse 35, do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest. And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. So there are two meanings in these verses. The primary focus is that larger work of salvation where the message of the gospel is being sown and it results in people committing to a relationship with God and living his way of life. Matthew 13 talks about this with the parable of the sower and the individuals who receive the seed of the gospel, and their response to it produces spiritual fruit. But beyond the overall labor of making salvation available that's described here, the message of the gospel is also producing a different kind of impact. So there is also the individual impact in the lives of those who participate in the work. Jesus clearly states that those who reap, those who participate in the work of the spiritual planting and harvest, receive wages. This, again, is the same word that we've been examining, misthos. There is a reward for this work, or a return on the effort invested, consistent with what we've seen in the earlier scriptures. There are several elements of this understanding that we will be rewarded for our works that can help us frame it correctly. And one of those is found in the next two verses. So if we continue in verse 37, Jesus goes on to state, For in this the saying is true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labors. As the New Testament scholar William Barclay writes in his comments on these verses, Jesus told the disciples two things. One, that the day would come when they would reap the harvest that his life and death had sown, and that the day would come when they would sow and others would reap beyond what they would see in their own lives. It always bears remembering that our physical and spiritual efforts are never entirely independent, but rather interdependent with the work of those who came before us and those who labor alongside us to build on the foundation that God has provided with a community of support. So Paul restates these principles in his first letter to the Corinthians. You can be turning to 1 Corinthians 3. And in 1 Corinthians 3, he's confronting division and sectarianism within the church. In his rebuke of those attitudes and mindsets, he reminds them both of our mutual dependence on God and one another, and of the individual responsibilities that we hold with the rewards that are available for performing them well. 1 Corinthians 3, starting in verse 5. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 5. Who then is Paul, and who is Apollos, but ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one? I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. So emphasizing the central role of the work that God is doing, but also the interdependent nature of our work with others who God is working with. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. We are God's fellow workers, and you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me, as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. So again, emphasizing both building on what others have done, but taking responsibility for your own portion of it and receiving the rewards of your own portion of it. Verse 11, for no other foundation Can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ? Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, so different amounts of effort, different amounts of investment expended, different types of works that can be done. Verse 13, each one's work will become clear. So there will be an individual aspect of what you have done and how it fares. For the day, a reference to the day of the Lord, or more broadly to a time of judgment, the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. Verse 14, if anyone's work, which he has built on it, endures, he will receive a reward. So in the context of all of these verses, it's clear that our works of righteousness will result in spiritual rewards, blessings that God promises beyond the fulfillment of having done what is right for its own sake. But to be clear about how we should view those rewards is critically important that we understand both what they are and what they are not. So what exactly is the reward or rewards that we will receive beyond the intrinsic rewards of the right character that comes from right living? Well, the parables of the minas and talents, from those parables, one line of thinking is that it will be a measure of responsibility or rulership of some type. From the teaching that the faithful will be kings and priests within God's government, another line of thinking is that the rewards may be connected to specific roles within that administration. And these interpretations could be true. However, the reality remains that the Bible does not fully reveal a specific answer to that question for our individual lives. So like children trusting that their parents have both the ability and the desire to bless them richly, for now we largely trust, based on what God reveals and what we experience of his character, that as Paul states in 1 Corinthians 2:9, the things that are prepared for those who love God are not yet even fully entered into the heart and the mind of man. For an expanded review of other scriptures on this topic that we don't have time to cover today, I'd highly recommend a sermon by Craig Scott titled Your Reward from God. Again, it's by Craig Scott. It's titled Your Reward from God. It goes into more depth than we have time for today. So in contrast, while the Bible doesn't disclose the details of what our rewards might be, the scriptures are abundantly clear that salvation itself is not a reward that can be earned through works of any type or amount. There are numerous scriptures stating explicitly that forgiveness, justification, or being declared righteous and redemption are free gifts that are only available through God's grace, which by definition is unearned and unmerited. We've seen the scriptures stating that righteous works will be rewarded, so how can we be sure that salvation cannot be attained as a reward relative to our works? Well, the strongest reason is that Paul uses the same word to state very clearly and specifically that salvation is not earned. Let's go to Romans 4, Romans chapter 4. Romans 4, starting in verse 1. Paul writes, "What then shall we say that Abraham our father has found according to the flesh? What did Abraham's works gain him?" Verse 2, "For if Abraham was justified, declared righteous by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, expressing his faith, and it was accounted or credited to him for righteousness." Verse 4, "Now to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt." Verse 5, "But to him who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. Just as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin. Verse 13, for the promise that he would be the heir of the world, talking about Abraham, was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, works, in other words, spiritual works, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law, spiritual works, are heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of no effect. Verse 16, therefore it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all seed, not only to those who are of the law or spiritual works, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham. Verse 4 is the key statement relative to our topic today. To him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. The word wages in that verse is, you guessed it, misthos. Same word that describes the rewards received in return for our efforts is used in this passage to clarify that justification, the declared status of righteousness that accompanies salvation yet to be received, is simply not available as a payment due in return for effort, only as a gift of grace. So belief in the spiritual teaching of rewards for righteous works is not in conflict with belief that salvation is available only as a gift, because it cannot be earned through merit. When we make the same clear distinction that the scriptures do, we see that they are two separate things. There is one more danger that we must understand to ensure that we have a right mindset when we approach this topic. We can very easily become distracted and veer off course by striving for the rewards that appeal to our human nature rather than for whatever benefits and blessings God chooses to provide in return for our effort. So in other words, as the old saying goes, it's all too easy to find ourselves doing the right things for the wrong reasons. In Jesus' teaching during the Sermon on the Mountain at the beginning of his ministry, he gave specific examples of right things done with wrong intentions: almsgiving or generosity, prayer, and fasting. And his teaching shows that the spiritual benefits and rewards for righteous actions, however inherently good they may be, can be canceled out for doing it for the wrong reasons. Let's go to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew 6. Matthew 6, starting in verse 1. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Verse 16, moreover, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. In all these examples, there's a common formula that boils down to motive. Why are you making the choice or taking the action? When the motive is self-gratification, Christ is saying, you get what you pay for. Temporarily fulfilling those selfish desires, which we all know may or may not work out the way that you had hoped for in the first place, is the only reward that we can hope for. William Barclay writes that the phrase used to conclude each example, "they have their reward," could be translated as, "they have received payment in full." Payment in full. To say it another way, if your motive is self-gratification and you receive it, that is all you will ever get. There's no continuing benefit, no lasting blessing, no expectation or anticipation of a reward yet for righteousness that is yet to come. In his concluding comments, he summarizes, "We would be sadly short-sighted creatures if we grasped the rewards of time and let the rewards of eternity go." To conclude, let's revisit the question that we began with. Is there a reward for righteous works? Let's summarize what we've learned. The scriptures openly teach that there is a reward for works of righteousness. As William Barclay states in his introduction to Matthew 6, "It is abundantly clear that Jesus did not hesitate to speak in terms of rewards and punishments. We ought to be careful that we do not try to be more spiritual than Jesus in our thinking about this matter of reward." So it is not wrong to recognize and even to pursue those rewards. Now, obviously, in the full context of biblical teaching about what righteousness is, our goal is not to pile up these rewards as we would pile up money or any other possession and see how much we can gain. We should also not shy away from seeing and thinking about the rewards that God offers as good and right motivation for living righteously. That said, the scriptures also plainly teach that any rewards resulting from righteous works are separate and distinct from the free gift of salvation. These two outcomes result from different criteria and different processes that cannot be confused. In addition, we must be diligent to avoid the danger of mixed or misdirected motives. Works of righteousness will only result in genuine and lasting rewards that God offers when they are motivated by an outgoing and unselfish love that reflects God's character, not by self-gratification. So when these conditions are met, we should pursue righteous works because they are right, because we love God and want to please Him, and knowing that there are rewards both now and in the future for choosing and acting on them. Let's conclude in Revelation 22. Revelation chapter 22 and verse 12 with the words of Jesus Christ. Revelation 22:12. "And behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is thus. My reward is with me, to give to everyone according to his work."